Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, January 26, 2024, and it is 1:02 p.m. We are meeting in the Max Gruenberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. I ask that you please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Shelby with the Juneau LAO and Sophia with House Records. Thank you for your work. The following members present today is Representative Johnson, Representative Gray, Representative Groh, and myself, Chair Vance. Today, on today's agenda, is the final day of our Justice and Human Trafficking Week during the National Human Trafficking Awareness Month. And we have two items on today's agenda to hear presentations from Covenant House Alaska and the Alaska Institute for Justice. We will first hear a presentation from Covenant House Alaska on human and sex trafficking. Here to present is Mr. Josh Lauhurst. He is also the chair of the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force. If you could please state your name for the record, you may begin walking us through the presentation. And I will leave it at your discretion if you want to complete your presentation before questions or take them as they come.
Okay, thank you. For the record, Josh Lauhurst, Director of Statewide Initiatives, Covenant House Alaska. Thank you for having me here, and thank you for hosting this week. This really, I haven't been able to attend to them all, but I've been able to listen to them all, and I, you know, am really grateful for all the other folks in this work. I've been working at Covenant House for almost 15 years, and on human trafficking issues for many of those years, and so I'm grateful for the momentum and the highlight on the topic. So I'm wearing two hats for most of this presentation, and that is one hat as Covenant House and one as the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force. And so we are a federally mandated task force that it's multidisciplinary, and it looks we're charged to look at child maltreatment response. And so as we're a multidisciplinary group, we'll come down as a group and meet next month. So we may come see you again, but it's just an opportunity for a multidisciplinary team to come together and look at the response to child maltreatment, and trafficking is a piece of that. And so that's how that fits in. Want to be able to go over today. Was able to check in with local law enforcement in Anchorage, as well as our folks on the front line at Covenant House. We're funded multiple ways with anti-trafficking dollars to be able to deliver anti-trafficking services. So within all of our housing components, we've grown. I mean, we were a shelter, and now we are really a housing continuum. We've been able to add micro units and transitional living and rapid rehousing vouchers and an array of things. And so all our folks are trained to be able to respond to young people who are experiencing trafficking. And so I had a number of conversations with our folks. So we'll talk about some trends, and then really want to think about prevention. And I really want to say I appreciate your comments, Representative Gray, on Wednesday about the sort of holistic nature of this. And I think that's kind of the direction that I want to go today, is that there's lots of ways that we can come at this, and we just got to decide what we want to do. And then talk a little bit about expanded community education and training, share our data with you. And then some of the recommendations that came out of that 2016 study that many people have referenced, as well as a few other things that we could potentially be working on. And then some of the proposed legislation that is out there right now also. So one of the trends that we're noticing here is that because of inadequate social safety net, meaning because our mental health services are not adequate, because our substance use mistreatment, because young people are falling out of OCS, because all of these things, every time a young person comes out of a system and is not met with housing and opportunities, to be able to be safe, that's a place where people fall into being trafficked. So like at Covenant House, we often see, we know when systems close, because API shuts down some beds, and then we have more young people that show up at our door with behavioral mental health stuff going on. So and those are the young people who are who become vulnerable to being trafficked, like you've heard all week. And so part of the conversation about, being able to make young people less vulnerable to being trafficked is looking at those systems and lifting those systems so that those young people don't end up in those vulnerable places. We currently are our state statutes, and I think some of this has been talked about too. We have hopes for some of that to be reformed. And I think in thinking about all parts of the work, I think there's the folks who are being trafficked, there's the buyers, there's the traffickers themselves, and then there's a prevention piece of this. Like, all of those things need to be addressed holistically, and so that's something that we are in favor of. One of the things that, like I mentioned, we have a number of federal funding streams. We have found those to be very cumbersome, and so it's we are super glad to have them, but we also, because we don't have any state or local trafficking dollars, that may be easier, hopefully would be easier to deploy. But the federal dollars, there's so many hoops to jump through, and it's a lot of extra work that could be spent, serving young people. So that's a current trend. In Anchorage, fentanyl has, in our shelter, we're having at least one OD a day. Narcan and, CPR needed. And so because young people who are addicted to fentanyl and trafficking victims who are addicted to fentanyl, the word from law enforcement was, it's almost like they're so addicted that it's almost like they're trafficking themselves, like, because they're seeking out the trafficker to get more fentanyl. Right. And so, and that's a tactic that's been used for lots of years with different things, but the fentanyl is just change the game. So again, in thinking about, other ways to come at this, and I did see that there was a big bust that just happened. And I assume that was part of this fentanyl stuff too, but, like, that's another way to go after, helping young people not to be vulnerable, is to figure out fentanyl, so we can get that out of here. I've been training I've traveled the state training on trafficking for more than a decade, and a lot has changed over that time. People used to try to fight me on, like, is this happening or not, or this is not happening, is what they would tell me. But I think there's a general awareness of trafficking in our community, I think, but folks don't really understand what they're looking at. So one of the things that law enforcement reports is that they're having more people report trafficking than they ever have. However, a lot of those cases aren't actually trafficking cases. They are DV or there are other things. And so they're using their limited resources to have to sort of suss it out. And so part of the conversation would be if we can have some more education initiatives so that everybody across the board knows what they're looking at when they're seeing trafficking, or when there's, if it's not that, and we know they look very close. And so not everybody's going to be an expert on that, but, that's something that they're experiencing. Another trend is young people not feeling safe coming forward, and not feeling like they can be protected. We actually this week had our fifth young person pass away since 2020, who was in a trafficking situation, but would not come forward because they were afraid. They were afraid that they would be harmed by their trafficker, and that our current ability with our law enforcement and others to protect her, she was too afraid. And we lost her on Wednesday. I think that's part of the reform around being able to build in services and opportunities. Like, once someone's identified, having a clear path of service for those folks is a huge deal. Like when I do trainings, if we're a service provider, every immediate need that is not being met is an opportunity for that person to go back to the trafficker, because the trafficker has been feeding them and housing them and all these things. And so if we say, come, will help you, but then we can't help meet those needs when they're trying to get out, then there's a chance that they go back, you know? And so we really need to work on our ability to protect folks and help them feel safe enough to come forward so that they can actually leave these situations. We continue to still see, you know, I know that a lot of the recruitment has gone online. We still, though, see places where young people who are experiencing homelessness, where they gather in our city, there's folks that are coming to recruit them there. That's still happening. And then I think there's also a trend or this intersection of forced criminality and trafficking. So traffickers forcing young people to commit crimes and then using that, you know, to say, well, if you, you know, we're going to hold this against you, or we'll turn you in, or that sort of stuff. And so that is also really, and that's where I think in like HB 68 with the vacature of convictions, you know, and I would vote for more things that could be vacated, because there's a number of things that folks have to do, you know, if they commit a crime because of the trafficker. And so anyway, that is another way between the fentanyl, the forced criminality, and folks feeling unsafe. Those are key reasons why young people are not coming forward, you know, to get help or to report to law enforcement. And if folks have questions along the way, I'm totally open for that. So feel free.
Well, I think now's a good opportunity to say thank you. All of what you've said is all of the things that I'm either currently working on or have plans to. And as far as House Bill 68 goes, it's currently, I think, close to a 60-page bill.
Okay.
We stuffed a lot in of protection for the vulnerable, trying to help victims, establishing the crime so that law enforcement can prosecute and bring justice. But obviously, you've highlighted there's so much more work to do. And so we're working on those steps, right? This is an awfully big elephant, but you are highlighting some really important things. And I appreciate you bringing in the connection to fentanyl, because that is another bill that this committee has addressed. It is a concern of the legislature and the administration as a whole, because it's impacting Alaska. The cartel has moved into Alaska, and where you have the cartel moving drugs, you have trafficking. And you mentioned this last bullet point is the intersection of the criminality and trafficking as coercion. Do you have any specific instances of traffickers using people not only for sex trafficking, but don't they also use them as mules to transport drugs that's a highly serious crime, and therefore puts them in a much higher risk than say just a prostitution charge. Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific instances in the state where that has been the case?
Yes. Actually, that study that we did in 2017, the majority of the young people who were identified as labor trafficking victims in that study, that's exactly what it was. They were being forced to run drugs. And so that it's very closely linked. And I think it is in part because, like, as you said, the folks who are running drugs are also doing the trafficking stuff. And so it's hand in hand, and it really it can blend together. But yeah, so that's definitely young people at Covenant House. If they're getting, you know, recruited into these places, the movement of drugs is a key part of that also.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I would like to note he has 30 slides, but if members have any questions just based upon what he has so far, we can entertain one or two. Mm-hmm. And seeing none, please continue.
All right. Thank you. This is, and I brought this up a little bit before, but there's a lot of ways to prevent trafficking and vulnerability to being recruited. And I think this list, you know, across the board, speaks to all the different things if someone has economic instability, if, you know, like I was thinking about the comment from, I think from Wednesday, about the familial pimping that happens. And I think, you know, I actually recently have been able to spend a lot of time out in Bethel, have been working with, we've been helping them lift some services out there. And I think about all of the pressure that is on people to just survive, right? Like housing is so hard to find, you know, childcare is hard to find, you know, mental health, like all of these things. And so like, you know, I think the question came up of, you know, like how could a parent do that? And I think, or someone that's close, but like, if you're in survival mode and you're looking for just ways, you know, to get to the next day, people start to do things that they would never otherwise do. And so I think if we can look holistically at the way Alaskans are living day to day, and take some of the pressure off, you know, that's a huge deal. And I think that would also affect, you know, how many young people are ultimately being trafficked. And so, yeah, when I think about prevention, that's what I think about, all these different areas. I think as a state, we got to figure out how to do this systematically, how to educate all of the folks. You know, I think, you know, in my interactions, you know, I know that like the troopers are definitely getting trained on trafficking and you know, APD and other, but it really varies from officer to officer, from judge to judge, from, you know, I mean, all the folks within our systems, really, you know, when I started this work, I was a youth pastor before this, like 5 years. I knew nothing about trafficking, zero. And then I started a Covenant House, and once I was taught, you know, we were taught by a really great group out of New York, how to see red flags and all these sorts of things. And then it just starts, you're like, oh, wow, this is right here. It's right in front of us. But if you don't have that, if you're not educated on that to understand those things, you don't see it. And so I think we really need to be working on systematic ways to train folks, because how it has been done in our community is just a few providers, a few law enforcement going around. And it actually, I wanted to shout out Special Agent Joan Godin at the FBI. She's about to retire. But for 20 plus years, she's been training around the state. And as I watched all of the different presentations, much of her training was coming through in everybody's slides. So just want to shout out to her for that. But then want to look at some data. So we use two screening tools. The first one we call the QGIT. It was verified actually by Covenant House New Jersey. It's a 4-question tool, and it screens for vulnerability to trafficking. And so when young people come in through our shelter and a number of our other programs, these 4 questions are asked. If they get flagged, then they get moved on to the second screening tool, which is the TVIT, the Trafficking Victim Identification Tool. It's a 20 question survey, or a little bit longer. And so that is a way that we identify young people, is through the screenings. And in the last year, we had 88 young people who were identified as vulnerable to being trafficked, and then 27 who were confirmed either by TVIT or verbal disclosure. And so that's, you know, when we think about the numbers out of the study from some years ago, and you know, I think we're looking at that 15 to 20% range still of young people, you know, based on the amount of young people that we are serving who are being screened in this, that are still, you know, being confirmed as victims. One of the things that we did at Covenant House a number of years ago is we compiled a list of young people who were having the most difficult experiences towards success and were not, you know, making progress. And we looked for common denominators in our data. And what we found was that a young person with less than one permanent connection in their life, one person, if you said, can I help, you know, who do you call? You know, if you have less than one of those in your life, if you have an unresolved disorder of some kind, whether that's substance use, mental health, behavioral health, it could, or you could be in a trafficking situation or a gang, like something like that, something that's unresolved. And then the most up-to-date numbers, if you have an income less than 1,341. And so we've been watching that in our data for a number of years. And it's proving out to say that if folks who have all three of these things, are more likely or exponentially more likely not to be able to leave homelessness. And the same goes for those who are being trafficked. So we've really been able to correlate that in our data. But so if we look at the young people who were identified, 32% of them, had none of those things. 25% of them had only one of them, 14, or I'm sorry, had two of them, 14, one of them. And then there was 3%, which I think is probably one person, who didn't have those. But so we can look at those types of indicators. And then the way that we do it at Covenant House is that we have focused our service delivery around these three areas. So we're working to help young people get a permanent connection, and we're working to help young people resolve whatever that issue is. And we're working with them to get to that income level, at least, and so that is a way too, that if we're thinking about young people who are being trafficked, like those are some key factors, key things we can be working on with them to help move them forward. And then just a breakdown, ethnicity breakdown. We serve about 60% Alaska Native young people, and many of them do come from rural areas. And that is part of why we have begun to look statewide, is because we want to be able to help lift supports in rural areas so that young people don't end up having to come to Anchorage for service, but could potentially be served in their own home communities and not have to do the moving parts, and have the potential to be recruited. And then by gender, have them split out too. Let's see here. Keep rolling. Oh, I got a few in there. Okay. So then just wanted to speak to some recommendations. And like I said, a number of these came out of that 2017 study. Some others have come from other places. But when we're thinking about statutes, legislation that can affect prevention, I think one of the things that we could do is to add human trafficking to the Aaron's Law, the Breeze Law, so that folks in schools are being trained to know, like kids know what this looks like, because that will go a long way, for them to be able to, well, often folks don't even, they're recruited into this before they understand what's happening. So I think that's a way. Also, just ensuring that there is a federal law that requires posting contact information of the National Human Trafficking Hotline, and there's a list on that, but just ensuring that we're actually doing that here in Alaska. I'm not sure if we are. When it comes to victims and survivors, I was talking about earlier that service track, and I think that's what safe harbor laws, if you've heard of the safe harbor term, really it's ensuring that a victim is treated as that and not as a perpetrator, which has often happens to young people because it looks like prostitution or it looks like something else, and they get treated in our systems as perpetrators versus as victims. And as a part of that, creating special protections for minors, the culpability on the perpetrator. And then I think this vacating convictions thing is a really big deal. And I think it's not just if you were charged with prostitution, but I think it's like low level. I know that it's low level drug charges in HB 68, but like there's a number of things that could be expanded to, I think, so to ensure that those folks don't get caught, not being able to get housing or something else because of a conviction. Alternatives to detention for young people. That's also part of the safe harbor, laws, more clearly defining forced labor, which I think that also is in HB 68, allowing for civil damages for trafficking victims would be helpful. And I know that there is some things, there's some access to victim service dollars that they can get, but, being able to go after folks civilly would be able to be helpful too. Let's see. And then, Yeah, the privileged communication that other folks who are experiencing domestic violence and other things get, it would be good to add that onto there. Going after traffickers, continuing to build capacity, right? I think, you know, I had a conversation with someone yesterday who said, well, we could put these laws into place, but are we going to be able to do anything about it? Because we don't have the staff or the people to, you know, the amount of folks to do it. So it's really looking at building our capacity throughout our whole system to be able to respond when, you know, to be able to prosecute folks when they're being trafficked or when they are trafficking. You know, enhance efforts to bring traffickers justice, and then remove the defense that trafficker didn't know that an age or that the young person was a minor. On the buyer side, and this, you know, there is the introduction of the patron of a trafficking victim in HB 68. But yeah, continue to find ways to bring buyers to justice. An idea is to potentially impound vehicles if they're used in you know, the procuring of sex. And then some places have really, they publicly, like billboards, stuff like that. And so there's ways to deter folks from buying sex if that becomes public, because a number of the folks who buy sex are also public figures, as and others. So, and then, and I think someone talked about this too, but the mandatory traffic education for folks, like they call them a John School or other things like that, and then remove the, you know, the defense that a juvenile consented because they can't consent. So I do have a number of your bills in here, Chair Vance. And, you know, one of the things, so I'm going to continue to wear my Alaska Justice or Children's Justice Act hat for this slide. And then after that, I'm just going to be Covenant House, Josh. And so we had as a task force had an opportunity to look at this last year. And we felt like, and as I have, you can see here, you know, the increased penalties, the vacation of charges, the patron of the victim of sex trafficking, like those are all things that we are in favor of. We do think that, and this is something that you've begun to work on with these additional bills, is that it's more comprehensive than that. And so our sort of sense last year was, this is a good place to start. There's lots more to do. And then really, yeah, looking at the public safety side, the victim services side, and the public health side as a three-legged stool. So now I'm just Josh from Covenant House, because we as a group haven't had an opportunity to look at all of these. And so, but when we meet next month, we will all come together and then we'll have some recommendations coming out of there. But as Covenant House, we recognize that one of the ways that young people get recruited or coerced is through pornography. And so, you know, that's something that we're definitely in favor of limiting. I have been on a lot of task forces over the years around trafficking, and almost none of them still exist. They come in waves, works, you know, there's little momentum, and then it falls apart. And so we're definitely in favor of establishing, like this current task force, the governor's task force, has made great strides, I feel, and being able to put that into statute would, I think, help us continue the work when there's ebbs and flows or when someone turns over, you know, so it's not just tied to a person, but it's systemic. The screening tools, HB 264, you know, I think the question is always, where's the data? Right. And being able to apply a uniform screening tool, which I think we'd be able to build on for the whole state, not just within DUFCS. So we would definitely be in favor of that. And we would also be, you know, able to help with our screening tools and or look at others, you know, as part of that conversation. I think the changing of the child pornography, you know, one of the big things we talk about when we're talking about trafficking and understanding it is ensuring that we're reframing this issue as child abuse, because very often it's not that way. It's, you know, teen prostitute or it's, you know, and things like that. And that's not a thing. That's a sexually exploited child. That's what that is, you know? And so, you know, how we phrase things is important. And so I think this child sexual abuse material, verbiage, you know, is, I think that helps reframe it for what it is.
Yeah, say it louder. Say it louder.
We also are in favor of HB 67, the Victims Trauma Reduction Act. And another reason that some people don't want to come forward is because, or that people don't end up being prosecuted, is because victims don't want to sit in front of a group of people. And also, they don't always, you know, they're not always in the best place. So they don't look like credible people sometimes. Right. So like you come in, if they're still addicted to something, they're like, it's hard. And so, being able to take what they've already shared, and not have to put them through that would be a big deal. And then I think the intersection of missing and murdered Indigenous persons. And so both, I know, Rep. Rowe, you talked about the two bills there. You know, we definitely would be in support of those as well. So that's what I have. Is there any other questions?
Questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back on the slide where we looked at gender, I noticed that the trans folks were listed there and non-binary folks. Can you just comment about being an LGBTQ youth and how that might put them at risk for sex trafficking?
For sure. Well, I mean, LGBTQ youth are disproportionately homeless in our country. And then they also often, when a young person comes out, if they're not accepted, then they lose their whole support system, right? And so I think that makes them so much more vulnerable, you know. I would say that one thing, and this is just my own observation, but when I was running our shelter, so many young LGBTQ folks were actually, like, their big trauma was that they weren't accepted. And so, but most of their upbringing, most of their growing years, like, they were pretty stable. And so, like, they would just take off in shelter, right? Like, once they had supportive community, like, that's all they needed, you know? But yeah, I think that young LGBTQ folks are definitely more vulnerable to being recruited. Yeah.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And this, you know, it's thank you, Madam Chair. It may sound frivolous, but when you say less than one support person, that's really zero.
Mm-hmm.
And I think less than one softens the fact that this person has zero support.
Yeah.
And I would encourage you to say they have zero support, because it's almost like there's a half a person out there or something that's helping them. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of just less than one, zero to me.
Yeah.
And if you've got zero support, that sounds like you're alone. Mm-hmm. Less than one.
Right.
And so I'm for, like, tell it like it is.
All right.
So just a recommendation, just in terms of communications and verbiage. And I don't know who came up with less than one, but they, I think they may have missed the boat a little bit.
All right.
It's still zero.
It is.
Could have three halves, and you still don't have zero.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're awfully quiet over there, Representative Groh.
Madam Chair, the only comment I made is that, and maybe with all this discussion of the base student allocation educational formula, where we talk about percentages of students, that there may have gotten some confusion arisen. But I agree with Madam Chair, with Representative Johnson's comment. I think that a clear statement of zero would be helpful.
Can you give us a picture, Mr. Lauhurst, of how many people do you have come through Covenant House every month? How many young people, so that we can kind of wrap our brain around some of these statistics?
Yeah, so in shelter, we serve about 250 to 300 young people a year. And so our expanded shelter services include, we have what we call our MAC house, which is for minors, and that's 13 to 17. And then we have at our youth engagement center on our main footprint, we go 18 to 24 now. And so there's about 300 folks that move through there. Collectively, though, with all of our expanded housing opportunities, we're serving about 1,000 kids a year. And so many of them are in apartments and they have what we call a permanency navigator attached to them, or they're in our, you know, transitional living programs or in our micro units, you know, and so we are serving more young people than we've ever served. Not all in crisis though. Like we've been able to build out the continuum so that folks can step by step, you know, move through and reach stability on the other side.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate all your work and looking at all of the legislation. The House Bill 67 is currently still in this committee.
Mm.
And I thought we had done most of the work on that, but it looks like there are more that we can do to support victims in that legislation. Mm-hmm. So I am going to be doing more in that we'll bring before this committee, because we are learning as we go, and I appreciate all that you've brought for us today, and I look forward to working further with you on what we can do to not only support our victims, but prevent trafficking in the future, because this is definitely my heart that we are able to stop it before it starts. So without any further questions from committee members, thank you so much coming before us today.
Thank you very much.
For our brief at ease, please. Back on the record. For our second and final presentation today, we will hear about labor trafficking from Supervising Attorney Alaska Institute for Justice, Anna Taylor. Welcome to House Judiciary Committee. If you could please state your name for the record and begin walking the committee through your presentation. I will leave it at your discretion if you want to entertain questions as you move along.
Great. So for the record, this is Anna Taylor. I'm the supervising attorney at the Alaska Institute for Justice, and I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the labor trafficking that we are seeing in Alaska. And I want to start out by thanking you and by thanking Chairwoman Vance and the committee for having us here. I think this is a really important topic. So if we could move to the next slide. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Alaska Institute for Justice and what we do. And then I'll talk about some of the power and control methods that abusers use, or that human traffickers use. They are similar to what domestic abusers use, which is why we've got power and control there. You're going to see some similarities in the vulnerabilities that I will talk about and that Josh talked about. That's because they're prevalent vulnerabilities and important to talk about. The Alaska Institute for Justice does primarily work on immigration law, so I'm going to talk a little bit about immigration status and how that's a tool that human traffickers will use. We will talk about the federal definition of labor trafficking. And then I will give some kind of examples of cases that we see. They are anonymized and kind of the details have been changed just to protect people's identity, but they're pretty standard cases. And then we'll talk a little bit about what the Alaska Institute for Justice can do for survivors of human trafficking. So next slide. The Alaska Institute for Justice is a nonprofit that was founded in 2005. We are dedicated to protecting the human rights of all Alaskans through legal services, policy, and education. There are three components to the Alaska Institute for Justice. The first and oldest one is the Alaska Immigration Justice Project, also known as AIJP. The entire organization was known as the Alaska Immigration Justice Project originally. As our mission expanded, we chose a more inclusive name. The legal program is still known as the Alaska Immigration Justice Project. The legal program primarily works on immigration law, so either getting people status or getting people more solid status, more firm status. Then we have the Language Interpreter Center, which trains interpreters and then has an online platform where you can request interpreters. The LIC, or the Language Interpreter Center, will also work with businesses or agencies or organizations to develop language access plans. And that enables people to know what to do when somebody who is limited English proficient walks in their door. That way, you know who to call for interpretation, you know how to get documents translated, you're not just making things up on the fly. And then we have the Research and Policy Department, which works with tribes in Alaska to address climate change. Next slide. So I've included some of our numbers here. We receive a grant from the Office of Victims of Crime in the Federal Department of Justice. And so these are statistics that we've gathered as part of our grant reporting. Between July 1st of 2022 and July 1st of 2023, we served 72 survivors of labor trafficking, 8 survivors of sex trafficking, and 17 survivors of both sex and labor trafficking. I think that comes out to 97 people total. Next slide. So here we've got our numbers divided up by age. We just divided by minors versus adults. So as you can see, we are mostly serving adults. The majority of our survivors are adult victims of labor trafficking.
Can I just pause you for a moment, Ms.
Yes.
Taylor? I just, for those listening who maybe cannot see the graph, I'm seeing that the age for labor trafficking reaches almost 70 years old.
Oh, sorry. That's quantities.
Okay.
Survivors.
Okay.
I didn't label my Y access. Sorry.
Okay. The number of adults versus minors. Okay.
Correct. Yes.
Thank you for that clarification.
No, thank you for pointing that out. So the next slide is survivors served by gender. Again, the y-axis is the number of survivors. So as you can see, most of our male survivors are labor trafficking survivors, or most of our labor trafficking survivors are male, but we've also got some female in there. Most of our labor and sex trafficking survivors are women, but we've also got some men in there too. And then next slide, I believe this is my last one on numbers. So this is by limited English proficiency. So 40 of our survivors were non-limited English proficient, and then 57 of them were limited English proficient. So that's kind of a confusing way to put it, but basically 57 people either spoke no English or spoke a limited amount of English. 40 people spoke either were native English speakers or were very, very comfortable in English. And then we'll move on to the next slide. So human trafficking can share a lot of similarities with domestic violence in terms of tools that traffickers will use to control their victims. Essentially, human traffickers will use any vulnerabilities that they can find to maintain control over their victims. I've got immigration status up here as the top one because I'm an immigration attorney, but then there's a bunch of other options here too. So, for example, if somebody is using your immigration status against you, they might say things like, you can't go to law enforcement because you'll get deported, or you can't go to a shelter because they won't help you and you'll get deported. But they can also work their way down that list, right? So you can't, nobody will believe you because you're crazy if you have mental health issues, or if you have substance abuse issues, it could be something like, I'm the only person who has access to that substance. I'm the only person who will give you that substance, so you can't report what's happening. Disability, again, human traffickers will use access to AIDS to control people. They'll use disability as a way to insult somebody or make them feel that they can't get help. I think Josh is, knows more about homelessness issues than I do, but again, traffickers will say things like, you can't leave me, or you can't leave the situation because you'll be on the street. Poverty and homelessness is a real vulnerability. Past history of sexual abuse and past criminal convictions, those are also things that traffickers will use as a way to control their victims. And the next slide. So the next slide is a power and control wheel. These are pretty common in the domestic violence world, but you can see there's some real similarities about with the types of ways that human traffickers will use and the ways that domestic abusers will use. So next slide. Again, I am primarily an immigration attorney, so we're going to do a little bit of talking about immigration statuses and then how those can be used by traffickers to control their victims. This slide goes from the bottom, which is the most vulnerable to victimization, goes up to the top, which is U.S. citizenship. Those people are going to be the safest. So we'll start at the bottom. The bottom is people who are undocumented. They are the most vulnerable. So those are people who entered the United States either without permission or came in with a temporary visa and then overstayed their visa. They are constantly afraid of deportation, and they are concerned with their basic survival, which makes them most vulnerable to victimization. Josh had kind of talked about the pressure to survive that he had seen in Bethel. That's the kind of pressure that undocumented immigrants feel too. And when you have that pressure of not being certain about your basic survival, that's when you get desperate. And that's when you're really vulnerable to victimization. As you move up the pyramid, getting a little bit safer, you have people with non-immigrant visas. So non-immigrant visas are temporary visas that have certain conditions. There's about 80 types of non-immigrant visas, so I'm not going to go into every one of them. I don't know all of them. But they can vary from things like tourist visas, where you have permission to come into the United States, you can travel around the United States, you can spend your money, but you can't work. Or there are student visas where you can come into the United States, you have to maintain a certain number of credit hours in your school. You have to stay as a student. One of some of the visas that are probably most pertinent to labor trafficking are the work visas. There are visas that companies can apply for that are tied to your employment. So that gives the company a lot of power over your immigration status. Moving up, getting safer, getting more stable, are lawful permanent residents. Lawful permanent residents have green cards. They can leave the United States and come back. They can petition for family members. Lawful permanent residents can petition for children and spouses. So we're talking really close family members. They cannot vote. And if they are convicted of certain crimes, they can be deported. And then last and safest are U.S. citizens. Naturalized U.S. citizens have the same rights as anybody who was born in the United States. The only exception that I know of is that they can't be president. But they can vote. They can petition for family members to come to the United States. If they are convicted of crimes, they will face criminal consequences and deal with all the other things that U.S. citizens deal with when they're convicted of crimes, but they won't be deported. So that's kind of the basic immigration world. Next slide, please. So this next slide is mostly talking about undocumented immigrants, where your immigration status really permeates everything about your life. It can mean that if you are undocumented, you don't have work authorization. So you're going to have a tough time. If you can find jobs, they're going to be short term. They're going to be low paying. There's not going to be a lot of security in those jobs. In Alaska, it means you can't get a driver's license. It can mean that you don't have a social security number, which not having a social security number means you can't get credit cards, you can't open bank accounts. It can be difficult to do things like rent an apartment or a house because you don't have any credit history. And then last but not least, it means that you have a real terror of reporting to law enforcement. And all of these things are things that make you vulnerable to victimization. They make it so that you're more likely to take work that you wouldn't take otherwise, and you're going to be less likely to report human trafficking to law enforcement.
Ms. Lauerhurst, we have a question from Representative Gray.
Yes.
Hi, thank you through the chair. On this slide, I could be wrong, and maybe you can correct me, but my understanding was that things were a little bit better prior to 9/11 in Alaska, and that we actually that there was some sort of ID or state ID that somebody could get that would help them, you know, exist. And we got rid of that after 9/11 as sort of like a terrorist prevention thing. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about that and if there's room for us to bring back some sort of mechanism for immigrants to have a driver's license, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I am not super familiar with the history, but my understanding is that that is what happened. 9/11 caused us, the state of Alaska, to kind of crack down a little bit on identification requirements. But, you know, not having ID it's a real barrier. It makes it so that, you know, I've had clients who weren't able to get non-emergency medical care because they didn't have IDs. I've had clients who weren't able to, you know, they had work authorization, but they didn't have a driver's license and they couldn't get a driver's license. And so then they ended up not being able to drive to work. And there are states, California and Washington state, I believe, both don't require immigration status to get a driver's license. The driver's license wouldn't be real ID compliant, so they can't use it to like board planes and things like that. But there is, you know, there are states that are issuing identification through the DMV so that people can function. I think that's particularly important given that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services have taken a really long time to make decisions on applications. And so somebody can be a victim of human trafficking, apply for a human trafficking specific visa, and still be waiting 18 months until they get status. And meanwhile, if you don't have ID, you're in a really tough, desperate spot.
Follow up, Representative Gray.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Taylor. Good news. I think that I have a colleague who's going to file a bill that would get rid of the immigration status check at DMV. That would be the simple part, is that if there just wasn't an immigration status check by the DMV for an ID or a driver's license, that would kind of restore things to pre-9/11.
That's my understanding. I don't know what it was like before 9/11, but that's, yeah, my understanding is that, and the other thing that we have run into at the DMV is, you know, immigration, as I just mentioned, is really complicated, and it's really hard sometimes to figure out people's immigration status. So it does put a significant burden on the DMV to be making those decisions.
Before you continue, Ms. Taylor, I'd like to note for the record that Representative Ruffridge has joined the committee room at 1:45 p.m. Thank you for your presence. I know that this is an important topic to you as well. Please continue your presentation, Ms. Taylor.
So if we can go to the next slide. This is a domestic violence and immigration power wheel. So it's not human trafficking, but you can kind of see in the center, you've got the standard tools that domestic abusers will use to keep their victims under control or to maintain control over them. Immigrants are going to experience the same tools and then a whole nother ring around the outside of additional vulnerabilities and tools that traffickers will use against them. And a lot of these that are on this wheel are going to be methods that human traffickers will use. You know, they will, like, at the top, by physical violence, is threatening to report someone to ICE. That is absolutely something that human traffickers will use. Threatening to report somebody if they work under the table. Again, absolutely something that human traffickers will use. So it's a DV, domestic violence power wheel, but it also applies to human trafficking.
Ms. Taylor, just for clarification, that these vulnerabilities also are, when you talk about immigrant, you're also talking about legal immigrants who are in the process of the system, not just undocumented who are technically illegal, but this is all of those that are in transition.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the further up that pyramid that you work, the less your immigration status is going to be a tool that a trafficker can use against you. But if you are here on a work visa that your employer got for you, that gives them, you know, even though you're here with permission, that still gives your employer a lot of power over you. Or even if you're a lawful permanent resident, if you're convicted of certain crimes, then you can get deported. So a trafficker could say, you know, I'm going to report you to the police, and they're going to deport you. So a lot of it can also be misinformation that people are using.
We have a question from Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mm-hmm. If you're on a work visa, can you get a driver's license?
Usually in Alaska, yes, if you get a social security number with your work visa. So a lot of work visas, a lot of work visas will get you social security numbers, because that way you can pay taxes on what you're earning.
Please continue, Ms. Taylor.
So the next slide, please. So it's not a coincidence that I am an immigration attorney, and I do a lot of, you know, working with labor trafficking victims. In, I think it was 2020, there was a class action lawsuit that was brought against North Pacific Seafoods. It was class action, so we don't know exactly how many plaintiffs there were, but there were about 800 to 1,000, many of whom were from Mexico and Central America. The lawsuit alleged wage violations, rodent-infested rooms, and murky tap water. Again, not a coincidence. During that time, in 2019 and 2020, North Pacific Seafoods got 393 H-2B visas. So H-2B visas are work visas. So you can see there's a connection there. The lawsuit, you know, didn't allege human trafficking, but I have a lot of questions about what was happening. I think that even if it wasn't actually human trafficking, it was exploitative labor practices. Polaris has found that in the agriculture sector, 76% of likely victims of human trafficking were immigrants. And the New York Times has just published a bunch of stories about migrant child labor. They spoke to over 100 child roofers. So that's kids, I think they were ages 10 to 18, who are doing dangerous work on roofs. And some really horrific stories about people, kids, falling off of roofs and getting injured. And Tyson Foods and Purdue Farm are being investigated for using migrant children to clean slaughterhouses. So if these don't talk about the immigration, the second two don't talk about the immigration status of the people who are being trafficked or being exploited, but you can see there's a connection and there's a pattern there. So next slide. So I work primarily in immigration law. The Trafficking Victim Protection Act defines labor trafficking as the recruitment, harboring, transportation, provision, or obtaining of a person for labor or services through the use of force, fraud, or coercion for the purposes of subjection to involuntary servitude, peonage, debt, bondage, or slavery. Next slide. That definition was a mess. Probably written by lawyers, we like to use a lot of words. What it really means is forcing someone to do work, is kind of the short definition. It's not about moving people. It's about exploiting them and using them for their work. You need force, fraud, or coercion to get somebody to do the work. So that can mean limiting freedom of movement, or not being free to leave. So people who can't leave their workplace, misuse of the legal system, that can mean threats of deportation, taking away documents. So that would be things like taking somebody's passport, which has their visa in it, or taking their social security number. We've talked about how crucial identification is for just kind of existing. And then work type or hours that are different than expected. So one example of this is if a trafficker told a group of women that they were going to come to Alaska to work as, or to dance as traditional dancers, and then they ended up being forced to do exotic dancing, which is what happened in 2001 at the Crazy Horse. So next slide.
Ms. Taylor, we have a question from Representative Gray.
Sorry, yes. I'm through the chair. And you can make me wait to the end if you need me to. But about the taking away of documents, I'll just highlight that. I lived in Saudi Arabia. They do you have to give your passport to your employer in Saudi for safekeeping. And then you have to ask for permission to go on vacation or leave the country. And I think it's kind of counterintuitive that people would think, oh, an illegal immigrant like wants to be here. But if you have their passport, they can't go back to their home country, even if they wanted to. Like, you know, you say, go back to where you came from. They can't. Their employer has their passport.
Yep. Or, I mean, if you don't have your social security number or your passport, you can't get another job. or you can't prove that you have status in the United States. Personal anecdote, but I once lost my passport and my identification, and it's terrifying to not have any way of proving who you are or that you have a right to be somewhere. And if your employer is controlling that, that gives them a lot of power over you. Mm-hmm. All right, so next slide, please. I think we're in the right slide, the AMP model slide. So the AMP model is a model that was developed by people who are much smarter than I. And this is a way of analyzing situations to kind of figure out if you've got human trafficking or not. What you're looking for is you want to have something in each one of these buckets. So the action bucket is kind of how did the trafficker hook the person in, right? How did they get them involved in the scheme? So that can be induces, recruits, harbors, transports, provides, or obtains. That's the very first part of the federal definition of human trafficking, of labor trafficking. The middle is the means. So that's more of how did they make the person stay in that situation. That's where you get your force, fraud, or coercion. And then why was the trafficker doing that? Is your purpose. In sex trafficking, the purpose is commercial sex. In labor trafficking, the purpose is labor or services. Next slide, please. So this is a labor trafficking example. Again, not Alejandro's real name. Some facts have been changed to kind of make things not more anonymous, but this is a pretty standard example that we've seen a few times. Alejandro is from a Spanish-speaking country. A recruiter for a large corporate farm met with him. The recruiter told him he would work 40 hours a week and that the farm would provide him with his own room. The farm paid for him to get to his work site. When he got to the farm, the owners took his documents. So we've talked a lot about how vulnerable that makes somebody. The farm was isolated. Alejandro was locked in dormitory-style housing until it was time to work. The housing was rat-infested and filthy, and the working conditions were unsafe. When Alejandro was injured, the boss told him to keep working. And instead of working 40 hours a week, he was working 80 hours a week. When the workers complained about working conditions, the boss was threatened to call Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So that's kind of our fact pattern. The next slide has the AMP model to kind of to analyze it, so we can move on to the next slide. So here you've got your, we'll start with action. So how did Alejandro get kind of hooked into this scheme? The employers recruited him. They transported him because they paid for his transportation. And then they provided housing. They provided very shoddy housing, but they harbored him by providing that housing. In the means bucket, we've got force, because he was locked in the housing. He had unsafe working conditions, and the employers took his work took his documents. We've got fraud, because he was told he would work 40 hours a week, and instead he was working 80. And they told him he would get his own room. He was in unsanitary dormitory-style housing. And then coercion, with threats to call ICE. And then the purpose of all of that was involuntary servitude, providing farm labor. So in this case, we've got we've got labor trafficking. We used facts very similar to that, and were able to get a trafficking-based visa for people in a situation similar to Alejandro's. Next slide. So our next slide is Jane. Jane is from Canada, and she's in a romantic relationship with a U.S. citizen. He encourages her to visit him in Alaska, telling her that they will get married. He tells her they'll split their time between the U.S. and Canada, and he pays for her flight to Alaska. When she gets to Alaska, he makes her do domestic chores and work in his store. When she doesn't work, or she doesn't clean, he hits her. When it's time for her to go back to her home country, he takes her in a cabin in the woods and refuses to drive her to the airport. So the next slide. So here's our analysis of Jane's situation. The action, how she got kind of hooked into this, is her partner encouraged her to visit. He gave her a place to live, put her in his home, and he paid for her transportation to Alaska. The means, the way he kept her here, or the way he got the labor out of her, was by hitting her when she didn't work for him. He physically prevented her from leaving by driving her away from the airport. And then fraud, because he told her that they'd get married. He presumably told her they'd have a happy, healthy relationship. And the purpose of all that was for involuntary servitude. She was doing domestic chores and she was working at his store. So I specifically chose this kind of fact pattern because it shows how there can be labor trafficking and domestic violence together. Sometimes something is just domestic violence. Domestic violence is a big deal. Sometimes it's just labor trafficking, but sometimes it can be both. And that kind of is demonstrated by the similarities and tools that traffickers and abusers will use. So I've given you a lot of, kind of doom and gloom about how hard it is to be undocumented, how hard the immigration system is. So I went to Google and I said, how do I get my green card? If we go to the next slide, which looks like it came up, that was Google's answer, which means it's complicated and it's hard, but that's what we're here for. AIJ helps people navigate the immigration system. So next slide. The first thing that kind of comes to mind when we're talking about labor trafficking is the T visa. The T visa is a 4-year visa. After you've had a T visa for 3 years, you can apply to become a lawful permanent resident. So you can start working your way up that pyramid. In order to be eligible for a T visa, you have to be a victim of a severe form of human trafficking, which is either labor trafficking or sex trafficking. Both Jane and Alejandro, people with similar situations, were able to get T visas. You have to be in the United States on account of human trafficking. You have to have not unreasonably refused to help in the investigation of human trafficking. So what that basically means is the T visa, part of why the T visa exists is to provide security and safety and stability for survivors. But it also helps law enforcement because it's encouraging people to come forward. T visas don't require that you report to law enforcement, but you have to have a good reason not to have reported to law enforcement. I tell my clients that their cases will be stronger if they make a report to law enforcement. And you have to suffer extreme hardship if deported. Next slide, please. There we go. Okay. Another couple options that we also look at when we're working with survivors of human trafficking, U visas are four-year visas that are available to crime victims in general. So there's a list of crimes. It's generally speaking violent crimes. And in order to get a U visa, you have to have been helpful in the investigation of a crime. So U visas require law enforcement certification saying that somebody is a victim of the crime and that they were helpful in the investigation. So again, U visas are also a way to provide safety and stability to survivors while also holding perpetrators accountable by encouraging survivors to come forward and talk to law enforcement. And then VAWA self-petitions are green cards that are available to close family relatives of abusive U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents. So going back to kind of Jane, if Jane had married her U.S. citizen trafficker, she might have been eligible for a VAWA self-petition. So that's kind of, we will screen for all of those things to figure out what is the best option. And then if we see something else, of course, we'll look into that too. Next slide, please. And that's kind of what I've got about labor trafficking. I've got my contact information here. I am always happy to talk about the work that we do and ways that we can help survivors of human trafficking. I've also got our Language Interpreter Center number up there. They are great for language access issues. Part of working with survivors of human trafficking is providing language access so they can say what their concerns are and what's happened to them and communicate easily. And then at the bottom, I've got our website. So I guess I will open up the floor to any other questions that people had.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor, for your presentation. I have a few questions. What specific industries are you seeing labor trafficking in Alaska?
So we are seeing people come from down south. We'll see migrant farm workers who have been trafficked down south and then come up here for safety. We've seen it in abusive relationships. Maybe a little bit in the construction industry. I have not gotten into any of the fish processing plants. I am very concerned about that lawsuit. I think that's indicating some pretty bad behavior on the part of, was it North Pacific Seafoods or whoever it was that was being sued. So those are places that I'm concerned. I am essentially concerned about any place where somebody is living at their employers. I've lived at my employer. I wasn't getting trafficked, so it's not a, you know, sure thing, but it is a red flag to me.
I find that interesting because of a housing shortage that so many more employees are building employee housing just out of necessity because, you know, just affordable apartments are hard to find in a lot of our communities, and it's been seen as a positive to have an employee housing for some of the businesses and new developments, but that does raise a point of interest to keep an eye on for labor trafficking that I hadn't thought about. But, you know, this is one area that has been, you know, sex trafficking has gone unnoticed, but labor trafficking even more. So I just want to bring our attention back to your first slide that you had more than 90 cases that came through your office within 1 year. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep. I think I added up to 97. But
are you aware of any other NGO or other organization within the state that deals with labor trafficking?
I know that Catholic Social Services distributes some funding and does some kind of social services for survivors of human trafficking, including labor trafficking. But as far as I know, we're the only ones who are kind of really dividing things up by this and keeping stats. And that's driven by funding. It's part of our grant reporting.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any further? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, on your T visa slide, I had a question about two words. The first one is when the eligibility is victim of severe form of human trafficking. And I'm just curious about the use of the word severe and what qualifies as severe human trafficking.
Yeah. So severe human trafficking is labor or sex trafficking as defined by the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. So they use the labor trafficking definition that I had on my slide. And then sex trafficking is basically the use of force, fraud, or coercion to induce somebody into commercial sex. And if you're under 18, no force, fraud, or coercion is required. So like Josh said, there's no such thing as a child prostitute. Under federal law, if somebody under 18 is involved in commercial sex, then they are a victim of human trafficking.
Follow up. My second question was about the final eligibility would suffer extreme hardship if deported. And I'm just curious about who defines what's extreme hardship.
Yeah. So these are applications that go to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. So they're the ones who are making decisions about whether something is extreme enough. When I'm doing applications, I'm looking into things like, would being deported mean you lose your social system, like your social supports in the United States? Would you have access to medical care or mental health services in your home country? So U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services makes that decision. But we're looking at a lot of different factors and kind of making the best, looking at people as a whole and figuring out how to make our best case.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Ms. Taylor, for your presentation and this information. It was very insightful. And thank you for your contributions to the Governor's Council on Human Sex Trafficking as well. I know that you have been contributing to that data that's helpful for the state. I just would like to point out for the committee members and for the public that an updated definition of labor trafficking is in House Bill 68 that is currently in House Finance. So it is my hope that that bill that updates the definitions of sex and labor trafficking will pass into law because it is needed. If you have noticed that the Alaska Institute for Justice and others are relying on the federal definition of sex and labor trafficking because our Alaska statutes are woefully inadequate. And I know that I just want to thank all of the committee members for doing the long work on that bill because we are trying to help support you in your work, Ms. Taylor and Mr. Lauhurst, in all of the advocates who have been doing the boots on the ground work for many, many years. So thank you once again.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee meeting will meet again on Monday, January 29th at 1 p.m. to hold its first hearing and hear invited testimony for House Bill 88, Warehouse Work Quotas. HB 63, Repeal Workers' Comp Appeals Commission, both by Representative Rauscher, and HB 170, the Misuse of Public Officer Official Position, by Representative Kronk. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect it is 2:24 p.m.